Today it gives me pleasure to introduce Sandra Nogue, who did her undergraduate and PhD in Barcelona, and then was a postdoctoral researcher in zoology here with Kathy Willis. And since last year, you've been a lecturer in paleosciences at the University of Southampton. So she's just in that early lecturer transition of insanity and everything else. But she's coping well. And welcome, Sandra.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back in Oxford. It's always very nice. It feels home. So, So I guess that everybody hears me in the back and everything. So, I have changed a little bit the title, as you can see here. And I focus more on maintaining forests and their services over time. So, basically, when we see one picture like this, what we see here is a fully functional forest, at least it looks like. Flowering trees, very nice shades of green, etc. So, basically, these canopies are looking like all the factors and all the processes in tropical forests should be working well. However, I'm a paleoecologist, so what I'm interested in is in the past. So basically, we know that all these forests, not just in the present but in the past, has been impacted by, of course, an increase of CO2 that we all know that it affects as well the carbon storage. But let's look in here as well, temperature. So here we have temperature for the last couple of thousand years, and here is a departure from the average temperatures. And what we are very interested in here is like in the last 100 years, let's look how the temperature increased super fast in here. Of course, in terms of 100 years, maybe a vegetation is actually responding, maybe it's actually responding in this moment, or maybe they have a delay in responding to this increase in temperatures. So one of the things that we can do, or paleoecologists in general, is seeing if we can have analogs of this increase in temperature in the past, and see how the forests actually can respond to this, if they can, or actually how they actually make the response to this changes of climate. But it's not the only thing that with paleoecological data we can actually help understanding in terms of forest responses. We all know that this picture illustrates very well the problem of deforestation and what actually happens when you leave this area here and start recovering naturally this forest. Or, for instance, fire, which is the impact of frequency of fire regimes, if they have been more intense, the flammability of the forest, etc. So all these factors in here are some of the important parameters that paleoecologists can actually help understanding in terms of time. But of course, I can see some faces here that they are familiar with paleoecology, but maybe some of you don't. So in terms of framing the time frame that we will be talking today, and just in terms of illustrating a little bit the time frame, we know that 4,500 years ago, we have the older Egypt civilization was there. And if we look here, Oxford approximately 900 years old. Not the building per se, but Oxford as an institution. So basically, we're looking here, and we start thinking if there is a link between civilizations and temperature. This is a very nice example of what is going on in the past. So instead of looking the last 1,000 years, what we're going here is from the end of the last glacial. So basically, part of the Earth is really glaciated towards the present. And what I really like of this graph is like the blue bits are like colder than average, and the red ones are warmer than average. And if we look closer, we actually have two Holocene climate optimums here. We have a climate optimum here during the Roman Empire and human migrations in here, and we have the medieval warm period here, followed by the Little Ice Age. So we can actually see that there is a lot of changes in temperature, that it might be less fast than the one that we are looking now, but they have been there. So one of the questions that we are really interested in seeing, okay, so how forests have responded to this, and actually what we can use from what we learned from the past to understand what is actually occurring now and how to conserve the forest in the Earth. And I really like this one, and I think that this mapping here illustrates very well the phenomena of changing that anthropogenic changes are making to the different biomes in the world. So we all know that biomes is a way of restructuring the different vegetation types in the world. However, they make a step forward in this one. What they are here doing, they are including the changes introduced by humans. So what you can see here, I just framed the tropics in here, And I just cropped these bits in here to understand a little bit much more the colors in this map. So basically what we see here is that in this shade of green, we have populated forest. In this one, remote forest. So let's try to look in this map where the remote forests are. Actually, let me know if I'm wrong when I'm pointing. So we could find some up here in the Amazon. We can actually find some here in Congo, maybe. And of course, in tundra and in the Arctic, etc. There are some. So I think that this is a good way of illustrating that actually biomes or changing has changed. And this is one of the, maybe I might be wrong, but it's one of the only maps that exists showing these changes due to anthropogenic factors. So what we learn as well, how what we learn from the past of how we reach this point in the map. Oh, well, and where are the islands in this map? This is one of the main, when I'm looking at here, and one of my interests are islands, and I was very interested in seeing which are the factors that we can actually see in islands, which are the changes. But let's keep it in mind, where are the islands in this map? But what I was saying before is, what we actually know from the past in all these areas in the world, and mainly in tropical forests, which are the main impacts that we know? So basically, Lydia Cole, that many of you might know, she did an amazing review collecting different paleo records published all around the tropical forest. So this means that going from Indonesia to South America and probably parts of Africa. Of course, a bit biased because it's what we have, what is there. And she started looking at these pollen diagrams that I will show you a little bit later, and she saw when the forest was changing, meaning declining, and which is the main factor that these forests are declining for. And not just that, how fast they recover. And you can actually do that with the pollen diagrams. So what she found is kind of very interesting and worrying as well if we're interested in conservation. Because what we have here is like there is a faster recovery following larger infrequent events such as cyclones and earthquakes. However, there is a slower recovery following small-scale human-induced impacts such as burning. And we actually know that there is a burning is one of the, I would say that one of the most important impacts that we have in several places. We just need to think in Borneo and the forest in there. So I found this kind of very interesting because we are facing a kind of slower recovery from these impacts. So this, of course, makes us think a lot about the recovery generally, of the recovery of the forest. And just to frame a little bit better the talk today, I'd really like as well to recover this rather classic question, how old is the rainforest, from Kathy and Hillary. And what we see here is like going again in the concept of what we actually see, if they are legacies of the past, or they have been pristine through time. And I think that this one is very nice, because it covers like different places in the tropics, in here. For instance, this one in Central Amazonia, they saw that 3,500 years ago, they were the Terra Preta. So it looks like it has been as well human impacts in the Amazon for at least 3,500 years ago. And of course, if we walk there, probably we will see a very grown forest in this area. But let's go to the straight to the other one. In New Georgia, in Solomon Islands, the virgin rainforest, imagine an island covered by forest currently now. But the researchers start thinking, how old is this forest? And of course, what they did is not just a core. What they did is collecting some historical records. And what they saw is that the composition of species that they are actually in this tiny island in here, it includes some of the useful trees, useful for humans. So it was very interesting because they actually were able to see that the forest covering this tiny forest in here, it is approximately 150 years old. Of course, all these aspects are important not just for curiosity as a paleontologist, it's important as well in terms of conservation, because it sets a baseline. It sets a very nice baseline of seeing where to conserve and how to conserve. And of course, there is plenty more examples, like the Shetland Island, in Papua New Guinea, they found agriculture 7,000 years ago. Of course, the impact of these agricultural activities in New Guinea, of course, they were more local. They were not massive and maybe very intense like what we have today. However, it's very significant that 7,000 years ago they found banana remains. So this I think that this sets a baseline, a different baseline in terms of how to conserve, and that putting the past in terms of understanding the forest that we have today here. I want to include it here as well, are some of the proxies that opal ecologies are using. So basically, there is a new kind of technique that they use ancient DNA. Why we use ancient DNA? Basically, to understand the species richness of the site. So what we do is basically taking a sediment core, so the top would be the present and the bottom would be the past. We slice it, and then we use several of these sediment left, to do different proxies. And what they do in ancient DNA is that they're collecting these, they are doing different techniques to extract the DNA. Normally it's chloroplast DNA. They send it to PCR, everything, and the metabarcoding, everything, and then we get back a massive list of the species richness of that area. Of course, limitations, there's lots, but basically what we get that we didn't get before this technique appeared is that we know the richness of species. And this, combined with pollen, that is this image in here, the tiny orange circles, there's all pollen grains, fossilized pollen grains. So basically, if you combine these two, it's a very, I would say, a strong tool, not just to know the species richness, but as well the abundance of these species. And of course, if we combine everything as well, we have phytoliths, that they are silica bodies, kept in between the tissue of the plants, that they just get in the sediment exactly where the plant was living. And of course, it shows a very strong proxy to know, for instance, banana phytoliths or more agricultural phytoliths that they are occurring inside. It's a very local proxy. And finally, of course, we have charcoal. This is what it looks like, micro charcoal, when you're looking in a microscope. So basically, the light of the microscope cannot go through these little particles. So you actually can reconstruct the fire regimes in the past. So using all these together, of course, it shows a very nice picture of what has been going on during time in the site that you're very interested in. That in my case, are normally islands and tropical forest. So let's go a little bit further with this. I found as well this example from Carolina Tobar, a former DPhil student from the zoology department, that she as well was very interested in seeing how human interactions with nature has influenced what is going on in this piece of land in Congo. We all know that Congo Basin has one of the big patches of tropical forest with a lot of endemic species. So what did Carolina is going to there, he cored, like this. This is the process of coring and taking the sediments. And she was comparing the different types of forests that there are in this area of the Congo. And there are basically four types of forest. We have the swamp forest, so flooded. Then we is followed by, I don't want to make a mistake, I can't see it. Marantasia forest, that basically is open canopy and a very dense understory of giant herbs. So we need to imagine that there are plenty of giant herbs in this area, followed by Gilberto dendron, that is a more specific forest dominated by this Gilberto dendron genera. And finally, the mixed forest, that is the one that is more widespread in this area and is the most diverse. So what she was very interested in seeing, the main question was, is the fire regime that has been affecting this forest one of the main factors influencing the actual forest that we see now? And she did different modeling. She cored 12 different sites. She collected all the microcharcoal and macrocharcoal of the site. And the final result, if we see here, is that basically, if we compare this is the charcoal through time, and if we focus with this one, we see that the period of fires in this type of forest has been starting 1,200 years ago. So one of the conclusions after doing all the models and comparing the different forest types and comparing the different frequency of fire is basically that, yes, it looks like the first one with giant herbs, the open canopy and very dense in the story giant herbs, it might be the result of extensive fire regime during the last 1,000 years. So, of course, I think that this is a very nice example of seeing that actually the past can help us understand what is, which is the composition of the different forests. Of course, there's a lot of questions. If fire would not be there, is this composition, this forest going to be extended in Congo? We can discuss this later, or email Carolina. She will be happy as well to answer. So why is all this important? Why we need to actually include anthropogenic impacts in forest ecosystems? So basically, it is often cited that 25 to 50% of the world's tropical forest has been converted to other uses since emergence of agriculture. 25 to 50%. I think that is a nice percentage. So while little information is currently available on management history and the driving force of historical forest changes, and especially in island ecosystems, we don't have a lot of information about this. And finally, as well, after a long workshop talking about which are the main important questions about paleoecology, the second one, what it means is that understanding local vegetation changes due to anthropogenic activities have become increasingly recognized as important research priority for the investigation of socio-ecological dynamics. However, we, of course, need to understand the baselines and the long-term data sets. Is that because it's, I find so important the image that I showed you before with the map of the world with the different sites in paleoecology and seeing that actually we have a lot of land use change in the past that might have been affecting what we actually see today. So I just selected several different places. Already we saw the Congo example, and I will focus in the Canary Islands, subtropic forest. Then I will focus as well in Western Ghats, here in the Malawi forestry system. And finally, I will show you a little bit about results, surprising results that I got like some years ago on the Tepuy Mountains in Venezuela. So, first of all, there are still significant knowledge gaps regarding extinctions, species turnover, and the resilience of forests in island ecosystems. Why happened this? Well, and I'm pretty impressed that there's not a lot of information because apart from islands are amazing places to work with, they offer us a great advantage of being an isolated and very well-defined space. So we know, actually, probably in terms of the past, when the humans arrived to these islands, so we can actually date it. And if we have very good dating on when the humans arrived, what happens is that we can decouple which of these changes that we see in the past in this forest that we're interested are coming from humans, or actually they are coming because of climate change or other factors that we didn't know before. So, and then it is really very important as well to understand all these impacts of not just humans as well, climate change, because there are a lot of island nations on the world that can benefit of this work. Of course, we need to think that these tiny islands in Polynesia, Melanesia, Micronesia, etc., they are really worried about the sea level rise that will happen. So there's a lot of work done in Madagascar showing this sea level rise in the past. So probably it would be a good idea to expand on all these paleoecological and paleoclimatological records in islands. But as I say here, it's not just that. Islands make up less than 5% of the Earth, but however, they are home to an estimated 20% of all birds, reptiles, and plant species. And as well, there are a lot of island species are actually in the red list, they are threatened species, endangered species in the world. So it's a kind of nice cocktail to work with. So the first example that I want to show is work done by the team in the Canary Islands, led by Lea de Nascimento. And this is a very clean and neat example of what happened when humans arrive in an island. We need to imagine, in Tenerife, in a place called La Laguna, that it means lake. We went there to core, and actually the lagoon now is dry and it's all built. So you need to knock the door of the owners and go to the gardens and ask them if you can actually core and take the sediments home. And it was successful, so was people were very helpful. However, let's think. So it's dry, it's under construction right now when it starts drying out. So there's a lot of early history as well to be included in the analysis of this record. So if we start as a baseline in the present, we actually know the checklist of species happening in Tenerife. We know all the endemics, we know all the trees, we know everything. However, imagine the surprise that when Lea was counting the pollen, she found like 4,000 years ago, oak trees and hornbeam that nobody really thought about it in that would have been happening in Tenerife and in the Canary Islands. So imagine, they found, and not just one grain, they found lots of pollen grains indicating of these species happening in there. And then suddenly, the Aborigines arrived. This is, I left it like this, like white, because still on the argument, if it has happened 3,000 or 2,500 years ago when the humans arrived in Tenerife. And look, a massive decrease of all these two species until the Europeans arrived, they even see, they even didn't see the trees living in Tenerife. Of course, laurel forest as well was happening there, but much more stable. And pine forest and Amophilus, shrubs and herbs, and the microcharcoal. Why the authors decided to link the extinction of these trees to human impacts? Basically, we can link very well these with the increase of charcoal. So they are just not logging the trees, they actually may be burning the sites. And actually the population of oaks and hornbeam disappeared. So this is one of the examples. It has happened in other islands like the Azores, but this is very difficult to find extinction of plants in the past, and this is a very nice example. So if you're more interested, it's published in 2009 in Journal of Biogeography. But it's not in the Canary Islands, not just is the human impacts are the main factor. There is an amazing forest called Laurel Forest. I'm not sure if any of you have been in Tenerife or La Gomera Island. There is an amazing forest with trees, very tall trees of Persea, Laurus, and a very nice kind of understory with a lot of ferns. So if you would walk there and you don't know that you're in La Gomera, probably you will think that you're in a high mountain tropical forest. Okay? So you will never put it in Canary Islands, at least me, if you walk there and you don't know the coordinates. So this forest, one of the main issues in terms of conservation is that they are linked with the cloud belt. And one of the projections of the cloud belt is that they will move up or they will shrink. It's not a clear answer. However, the final output it will be that it will be like thinner. And one of the main questions that sometimes we are asked is like, what would happen with the laurel forest? Are we going to lose the laurel forest because of climate change? It's not an easy answer. However, what we see here for the last 9,000 years is that these two trees, Ericaceae and Morella faia, that is like the shrubby bits of the laurel forest, they are starting increasing, and even more for the last 5,000 years. However, Salix, Felix, and Laurus in here, Ericaceae, are starting declining, that these are the ones that they are more like linked with what we actually know about laurel forest. So this makes us think that maybe there is a regional climatic change, because of course humans were not here 5,000 years ago. So what we saw is that during humid periods, we have more or less this landscape. We need to imagine this. However, during dry periods, what we see is a kind of increase of the Ericaceae and Morella type of forest. So according to our results, what we can expect if we turn into humid environments in the near future or dry environments is this change of reduction. Not an extinction, because we haven't seen an extinction or massive reduction of these forests. However, we've seen a kind of turnover that is changing from Ericaceae and laurel forest to this kind of landscape. And now we're more happening in the edges of the natural park. So this is, in the past, what we're learning here is that the change that has happened in the African period, when the Sahara Desert was starting developing, is when this change happening here. So maybe it's linked as well with this regional global climate change. And finalizing islands as well, there is a very nice example going a little bit further in New Zealand, in Purnites, that as well, it includes ancient DNA. And what they saw is a complete turnover of species. What they saw is that when Maoris arrived, they start planting, and Europeans planting different trees. And they actually use these words, they're using the island as a garden forest. They include the trees that they like, they include the shrubs that they really like. And then what we see here is a change from wetland herbs, Podocarpus, so from a conifer and a palm, 2 metros severos with beautiful flowers. So I think that this is another nice example of seeing how humans as well can import different plants in habitats, that's in island ecosystems. So now we will move a little bit from islands to Western Ghats in India. And the question is a little bit different. It's not about when humans arrive in an island, etc. It's about what we can learn from agroforestry systems, that is the practice of planting crops on the shade trees, and how to maintain these biodiversities across space and time. So, well, one of the best places to do that is in Western Ghats in India, where you can see in this mapping here that is already very fragmented. There are basically pieces of crops, plants, like a mosaic of croplands, little patches of forest in here, as you can see, and some of these patches are called sacred sites. So they are actually protected for cultural belief, and because it is part of the culture in here to have like a lot of sacred sites. Like for instance, there are 4 sites, 2 sacred. There are like 900 in total sacred sites in this area in here. And what we did is basically go in there and we cored 2 agroforestry sites, core and agroforestry sites, and 2 sacred groves. So we will have like a kind of nice comparison because in between like 2 land uses. And this is what Shonal and other people did in the field. As you can see here, it's not a lake either. It's a tiny forest hollow, but it's perfect as well for a forgetting course because as well it makes the same function like a lake. So we get the coursing here to Oxford, and we start analyzing. And one of the most straightforward questions that we actually were able to collect in here, after doing all the coring and after doing all the counting, is that, okay, how old are the sacred groves that they are using for cultural service? So basically, let's look at this graph. This is, again, years before present, so past to present. And here's the percentage of the different species. We group it in functional types. So basically what we have here is forest, and here we have this more grassy and agroforestry type of plants. And basically what we see from these 2 sacred groves is that basically the forest is increasing a lot, and mainly for 400 years for both sides. So this was a very straight of question, and we have the answer. So we actually can say that forest is like more or less 400 years in the same place. So this is the first question that we were very interested. However, we were very interested as well in trajectories of forest change. So not just that increase, but why. And we did, and we included the 2 agroforestry sites. And these are basically influx, is not percentage, influx of pollen as well in functional types in the 2 sites, the sacred groves and the agroforest. Just looking at that, we see that it's different, isn't it? We see, for instance, that forest, they're increasing as well in here. That is the one that is 400 years. Agroforestry systems are like not following the same trends as these two sacred groves. However, if we look at poaceous and cypraceous, what we see here is the sacred groves are like lower in influx. Herbaceous, we separated poaceous from herbaceous because here are more than the story type of species. So we wanted to see what was coming from more poaceous and on the story. But look at here, we have lots of herbaceous, have lots of poaceous, etc. These are crop taxa. Crop taxa here is like very low and lots of spikes. Basically, when we see these type of things in here, when in paleoecology, it means that this kind of spikes means that they are human introduced. And this is a charcoal, so the fires. If you show this to a paleoecologist, they would say that this can be like shifting cultivation, like burning, planting, burning, planting. So it's a very interesting way of seeing just like that without doing any model, just producing and plotting the data to see what was happening in the landscape in this area. But we did a little bit more. We were very interested in seeing the canopy. the canopy dynamics. So here, basically, what we did is divided the pollen types into arboreal and non-arboreal. So basically, what we see here is a canopy closure. Again, let's look in here. 400 years, of course, a canopy is getting closed, basically because there's more forest, so it makes a lot of sense. However, looking in that way is a very nice way of seeing a forest with the different strata. And this one in here is the concentration, basically, because we're talking about influx, of long-lived trees. So basically, these are the long-lived trees that we have in our site. What we did is linking the pollen taxa with the corresponding long-lived trees in sight, and this is the list. So if you're interested, I just come and I can give you this information, because basically it's just showing that we can link pollen taxa with the actual species. For the people that is not familiar with paleoecology, one of the limitations is that it's very difficult to get species level. We need to go to genera or family, because you cannot identify the pollen ranges because of the morphology. However, we have lots of hope with ancient DNA, because then you actually can say that. This, for instance, Rhytides in here is Rhytides elata. That is one of the things that you can avoid working in islands, because endemicity in islands is high. So if you find some species, you can actually link it very well with the endemic species inside. So here we go. And finally, this is a trajectory of forest change. So this is a PCA with all the data. What we see here is, like, we have two sites in here that I tell you that are the sacred sites. That is for the last 900 years. They are more or less, in terms of composition, in the same place, in terms of species composition, and move linearly towards here, the Peruvian forest. However, look what happened with the agroforestry systems. This agroforestry system, it goes back here, that it looks more like the beginning of the sacred site when it was not there, and it moves towards here. And this one stays right here. So we were concerned about that. And what we did is building a model, and we put together different parameters. All the canopy opening, the long-lived trees, the charcoal, the crop frequency. And what we found is this. It's logical as well if we've seen the PCA, because basically we see that the sacred sites are linear, responding. However, that agroforestry systems as well are kind of, they're showing divergent trajectories of change. In terms of conservation, what we can say in here, that basically, in my opinion, you need to go to landscape level to protect, because each forest patch in the past or in the present are responding or in different periods of time. In terms of responding to the different factors. And finally, just this, we did as well a study with phytoliths, because pollen sometimes can be blown from the site, outside the site. So basically, we have a kind of nice correspondence between what is on site and what is blown by the pollen outside. And as I told you before, I'm showing a lot of different changes. However, one of my questions was, has everything changed? We really don't find any forest that has been stable over time. And then I went back to my PhD. Because I was doing a core on top of one amazing mountain called the Tepuy Mountains. And I remember, it's even painful thinking it, because I was counting lots of pollen grains. And basically, nothing happened. Nothing happened during the last 12,000 years. Suddenly, all my conclusions of what I was saying now, like lots of changes, humans' impacts, climate change. So on top of this Tepuy, actually it's this one here, in Chimanta, Peruola Tepuy, nothing happened during the last 12,000 years. We tried, and no. It's like the same kind of tree. Well, maybe a little bit of fluctuations, but if you do the average, you will not see a lot of different changes. And the same for herbs, others. And we see here like a little bit more of changing here. But compared with what we saw in the other examples, it's pretty stable for the last 12,000 years. How I explain that? It was very frustrating, because you need to explain something. And in my case, I didn't have any
kind of independent record in terms of climate. We knew that at least, this is a sacred site as well, it's very high, you need to reach it by helicopter, so we ruled out the impacts of humans. Climate change, we saw different climate change down on the lowlands in the savannah. However, what we said is like there are two options here. Maybe you can help me thinking in a third one. Basically, resilience. These species are resilient. However, I will tell you why I doubt it. Or it hasn't been during the last 1,000 years, massive climatic change affecting top of these mountains. Why we think that the first one might not be the answer is because they did some expeditions like 10 years before I started going there, and we were able to see where they actually planted the tents. So like the steps. So probably they are not very resilient to human impacts. How is an amazing system? And stability in 12,000 years is very difficult to find. So basically, thank you so much. And I'm ready for questions.